My name is C.S. Song. On our website, againstthegrain.org, you can learn about Laurent Dubois. We have a link to his website at Michigan State University. You can learn about him and his books. And we have a particular link to Avengers of the New World, the story of the Haitian Revolution, which we're talking about today. Again, Saint-Domingue is the western part of the island of Hispaniola, and in 1804 it eventually became Haiti, although the revolution that began in 1791 by primarily the slaves of that portion of the island became known and is known as the Haitian Revolution. Laurent Dubois, Toussaint Louverture, now a legendary figure, a legendary leader of the Haitian Revolution. We could spend several hours on this man and his ideas and his ambitions for Saint-Domingue. What do we need to know about what he wanted for the island once, well, as a leader of the revolution, what he was aiming for?
Well, he's an incredibly compelling figure, and obviously a very famous one who's been evoked throughout time. And if for those of your listeners who are interested in learning more, Madison Smart Bell's trilogy of novels about the Haitian Revolution focuses on Toussaint, are quite an interesting reading of him. But I think that fundamentally he was at the heart of a contradiction, which is that he wanted to preserve liberty, he wanted to defend emancipation, he wanted to protect the freedom that he and his comrades had won, and at the same time he needed to do so on the foundation of a slave colony. And he struggled, I think, to find a way to do that, but he ultimately determined that Saint-Domingue needed to keep producing sugar and coffee in order to, as a way essentially of preserving its own freedom. And he also, I think, was particularly astute, but also dealt with a very complicated geopolitical situation in which there were enemies of liberty quite strong all over, in fact, the British, the Spanish, different slaveholding empires, but of course enemies within Republican France as well, who were never quite happy with what had happened in 1794. So he tried to balance things. He tried to balance, on the one hand, the protection of emancipation, and on the other hand, the maintenance of a plantation economy. And the contradictions of that, I think, in the end, were perhaps too much to balance. And yet, he, of course, laid the foundation for the birth of Haiti in 1804, and has to be remembered as kind of the central pillar of that revolutionary period, even as he's a complicated and ambiguous figure in some ways.
And so rebuilding the production of sugar and coffee in Saint-Domingue, this requires, of course, workers on the plantations, people going back to work and producing these commodities. What, in his mind, did this rebuilding process then require of these ex-slaves who had been recently emancipated because of what happened in Saint-Domingue in 1793 and, of course, the National Convention decree in 1794?
He ultimately believed that most of them needed to be continuing to work on the plantations. He was not alone in this. In fact, the island of Guadeloupe that I've written about in the other book had metropolitan administrators, so administrators sent from France, who came to basically the same conclusion. And the argument in both cases was essentially that, that liberty had been granted, but that this did not mean that the plantations could be abandoned. And while for many ex-slaves, I think the dream certainly was to leave the plantation or to really actually to take over the plantation and make it their own plots of land that they could farm for their own profit. For Louverture and for other administrators elsewhere, there was a real desire to keep the plantation running. And of course, since many of ex-slaves did not really like that, that ultimately led to the creation of a series of coercive tactics, policing laws that kind of kept them from moving and so forth. It should be said that the situation that they were in the plantations was not the same, and most importantly, they were to be paid for their work. So that, of course, was a dramatic change, and they certainly had rights to complain about conditions, and there was a set of processes that was meant to protect them in certain ways, and even the right to kind of have contracts and to move around after a certain time. They clearly, it was a difference from slavery, and that's clear because when the time came for the French to even reverse that regime of Louverture, they were ready to die, in fact, rather than go back to slavery. But that doesn't mean that it also wasn't very limited in certain ways, or at least in ways that they saw as strong limits.
Right. So, I mean, in describing what Toussaint Louverture created and wanted to create, You use terms in your book like surveillance systems, forced labor, militarization of plantation labor, quote, a new police state. This sounds quite draconian. And could you tell us a few more details about that system and also how ex-slaves responded to that system?
Right. Well, it's it was common, actually, interestingly, to the French Revolution as well, and in the sense the revolution itself gave rise to new forms of surveillance and policing. But this, the pinnacle of this took place in 1801 when he, in his constitution, Louverture laid out a very, very careful sort of very careful regime that was meant to assure the plantations. And what it essentially meant was that laborers had to work on the plantations, and they did not really have the right. They could move under certain circumstances and under certain processes, but in general, their lot was to continue laboring on the plantations. Their wages were set by a kind of process of division of what was produced. And if they broke away from that, they were subject to very fierce reprisals that were carried out by the local police. That was essentially his military. It's quite dramatic, especially since the police and the military were themselves ex-slaves. So there's a kind of social fracture here that we're talking about. On the one of the great kind of topics that still needs to be explored, because it should be said that a lot of needs to be really better understood about this revolution, is really how this worked on the ground, how it worked on the day-to-day, and all those questions, I think, still need to be really explored by a historian. But certainly that was the idea that Toussaint had created. And he worked closely with planters, whites, who had fled the island and who actually saw in Toussaint a great protector, and many of them returned, and they saw in this regime a certain possibility for safety. He also seems to have believed that their expertise was necessary to kind of maintain the plantations. There were obviously interstices in which this didn't happen, and there were certainly people who managed to escape this draconian policy. But if one reads the 1801 Constitution, you see that there's a really strong series of policies that are meant to essentially contain the people. And there is a split in the sense that Toussaint, there was always a way out, which was the military, which was obviously open only to men and not to women. But for those who were in the military, there was a very different set of possibilities than for those who stayed on the plantations.
In addition to the economic motive, the desire to rebuild the economy of Saint-Domingue so it could achieve what it wanted to achieve for itself and for the colonial power of France, it also seemed like Louverture was very focused and concerned about what French folks over there who now hear about the emancipation of all these slaves in Saint-Domingue, how they would see these ex-slaves after emancipation, how they might behave and what conclusions they might draw on about the advisability of abolition. Can you describe that?
Yeah, Louverture understood, rightly actually, that there was an enormous hostility and, of course, an enormous racism that was present, even despite these decisions that had been taken by France. And he was very, very concerned about the possibility that the emancipation would be reversed. I think he became concerned about that very quickly. And he had reasons to be, I should say. I mean, that there he had good reasons to think that there were those who wished that to happen. And so the question of the image that French people had, not only the image, but the fact that he was very sensitive to the fact that a massive economic the revolution had sort of eliminated this huge economic force for France, and a lot of people were out of work because of this and so forth. So he was sensitive about the effects, and he was also sensitive just to the ways in which they would be represented. So it's true that in his conversations or his declarations to the people in Saint-Domingue, he emphasized very strongly that effectively the liberty had come, but it had to be kept, and that there was always the possibility that the French would turn against it. I think there's another point too, which is more strategic, which is that he also just needed foreign exchange. He needed money, and he needed money in part because he wanted to make sure to have the weapons and the possibility that to actually defend that liberty. And I think he also understood quite early that he might have to defend that, as he ultimately did, in fact. So a lot of the goods that he produced, part of the aim, I think, was actually to buy guns and ammunition to sort of sustain that revolution against its possible enemies. So there's that element too, which is, more military and pragmatic than ideological.
Laurent Dubois, author of Avengers of the New World, speaking with us today on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and KPFA.org. Now, many listeners and many people who have learned about the Haitian Revolution might understand, Laurent, this conflict to be primarily black versus white, right? Black ex-slaves, mostly from Africa, against the white slave owners, the white elites in Saint-Domingue. And yet, There were apparently, according to you, some whites and some free coloreds who didn't exactly accord with this. Can you describe?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's all through the story, actually, there's various alliances that are made. I mean, the most significant I've already mentioned, which is that between Sonthonax, who really abolishes slavery in 1793, and the insurgent slaves that come to his side. There's a very tight connection between a general named Etienne Lavaux, who's actually an aristocrat, a French aristocratic officer, but who ends up becoming very sympathetic to the revolution and writes some very powerful defenses of that revolution and even tries to push it further. For instance, he writes that the slaves could demand reparations and money for the time that they had been enslaved, which I think may be one of the first people to suggest that, even in the 1790s. So there were, I think, on the basis of principle, a number of whites who supported it, and quite importantly, well-placed whites who supported it. And there were also many who pragmatically made their deals with Toussaint Louverture and continued to stay. During the War of Independence in 1804, there was a certain number of whites, mostly Polish, in fact, who were in Napoleon's troops and who seemed to have defected to the other side, maybe for ideological reasons, maybe just because it was the smartest move at the time. So I think all around. The other point is that there were also plenty of people of African descent who took complicated sides, many who were enemies of Louverture, who fought with the French at different times. So I tend to suggest in the book that the categories of race that are usually used to sort of understand this aren't the most useful ones, that the way that racial identities were formed and reformed during the revolution is something we need to explain rather than something we should use to explain the revolution.
Before we get to Napoleon Bonaparte, who took power in 1799 and had a lot to say about what happened in Saint-Domingue, in what ways did Toussaint Louverture, who aligned himself at least for quite a while, I think, beginning in 1794 with the French Republic, and he fought for them. He had a number of titles given to him by the French regime. In what ways did he begin to chart an independent course for Saint-Domingue, thereby worrying or alienating the French authorities?
Well, it's really by 1798, I would say, that he starts to sort of chart a somewhat independent course. And there's a kind of chicken and egg question here, which is, in other words, which started what? Because there is, by early 1797, already the rise of a kind of powerful forces in France that are seeming to make headway in attacking emancipation. And I do think that that Toussaint's approaches in 1798 had something to do with that. But it's certainly true that he oversaw. I mean, for one thing, he clearly wanted to be the one in charge in the colony, and he wasn't interested in having white commissioners sent from France take over and tell him what to do. Which they did try to do, and he kind of dispatched them relatively quickly. One understands, I think, pretty clearly that agenda. But he also, in that process, negotiated the withdrawal of the British, which, of course, was a great victory for France to have the British withdraw from Saint-Domingue. But he made sure to control that withdrawal, and he made certain kinds of deals to make sure that he would have trade both with the British and with the United States. At the time, of course, the British and the United States, the U.S., both in a kind of brief thing called the Quasi-War, were in conflict with France. So in doing so, he really was going against the grain of what the metropolitan leaders would have wanted. So he starts to make his own diplomacy, basically. He starts to operate a little bit as his own state. He wants to make sure that the country will be supplied with the goods and provisions and, of course, guns that he thinks he needs. And he makes his deals. He deals directly with John Adams, actually. And the U.S. government, in fact, helps support Toussaint Louverture in a war against one of his internal rivals, with the Navy actually supporting him. So, interestingly, there's actually a connection under the Adams administration, quite direct connection between the U.S. government and Toussaint.
So we have this immensely powerful man, Toussaint Louverture, holding sway in Saint-Domingue, getting rid of his rivals, sending French commissioners back to France. Napoleon Bonaparte comes to power. He sees what's happening in Saint-Domingue. He begins to understand who Louverture is and what he wants. What does Bonaparte do?
Well, Bonaparte has a kind of dream. It's called a kind of dream for a reconstruction of the American Empire. The French Empire in the Americas. Obviously, France had lost Canada in the Seven Years' War, and then had also ceded Louisiana. So essentially, what had once been a quite large French Empire had become much smaller. And now Saint-Domingue was under the power of Louverture, a former slave. Saint-Domingue, which had been the jewel of the French Empire. So Bonaparte's plan plan is to try to rebuild the French Empire in the Americas. But he does it in a certain kind of way, and I think he in some ways kind of hesitated and I think thought about different options. But the option that he ultimately chose was, first of all, to reacquire Louisiana, which he saw as necessary to really supply provisions for Saint-Domingue. Actually, Louisiana was really just meant to kind of support Saint-Domingue. But most importantly, he wants to get control back over Saint-Domingue, and he wants to rebuild the economy there. It's not exactly clear when precisely he decides to reestablish slavery. It's still something we need to know more about. But he does eventually choose to reestablish slavery. But before that, he sends missions to Saint-Domingue, which have two kinds of goals. There's a public goal, which is to support the revolution and bring more troops to the area and so forth. And then there's a private goal, which he issues in secret instructions, which we do have, which is essentially to destroy Toussaint Louverture and his elite army and to kind of take back control over the colony. It's partly a response to Louverture's 1801 constitution, which really was quite autonomous. But it also is a response to a lot of other things. So that's what happens in late 1801 when a massive military mission goes out from France. It's able to go out because now there's suddenly peace with the British, which has been negotiated. And that mission then sets in motion a really cataclysmic war in Saint-Domingue because Napoleon's idea that his troops were going to be able to turn back the clock and reestablish an old order was very mistaken.
Right, and Leclerc, who was sent by Napoleon, uses terror, uses a kind of racist delirium. The French lose moral authority. There's a mass uprising against the French. You can read all about it in Avengers of the New World. And Dessalines prevails. The future Haitians prevail in late 1803, and the new independent nation of Haiti is founded by declaration in 1804. In the few minutes we have remaining, Laurent, I want to talk about the impact of this revolution on thinking, on action throughout the centuries. First of all, what did the Haitian Revolution mean to other enslaved people in the Americas? What did they see this event as an example of?
I think for other enslaved people throughout the Americas, this was a real inspiration. The fact that slaves took on their masters was not new. Many slaves took on their masters, and sometimes they succeeded in creating maroon communities and so forth, but never before had a group of slaves taken on their masters and won to this extent and really just ended slavery. So it was a mark of a possibility. It was a mark of pride, of dignity. Certainly the figure of Louverture was, you know, there were medallions with his figure that people wore in Brazil. There were all kinds of songs about him and so forth. So just the sense of dignity and independence, and it directly inspired, I think, in a number of important revolts. So it had that effect, I think, quite clearly, and by the same token, for the same reasons, it, of course, frightened a lot of masters.
And you write that the Haitian Revolution became a touchstone in subsequent debates about how best to move from slavery to freedom. Mm-hmm. How so?
Right. Well, there was obviously a lot of different representations. For some people, it was a triumph, and for many whites, it was an example of a disastrous process, of the dangers of giving too much freedom too quickly. And so, as people debated the process of emancipation and what should happen in emancipation, people made constant reference to Haiti. The British abolitionists made constant reference to Haiti, some sympathetic, some unsympathetic. There was a lot of debate about the role of violence and whether, you know, to what extent violence had been used appropriately, or whether the use of violence by the insurgents was effective or was morally justifiable, and so forth. So in these ways, just because it was a successful slave revolt, everybody really turned to it to try to understand questions that arose out of it. It was also, of course, the first really large post-emancipation experiment, the first case in which large numbers of slaves had been freed on plantations. So people looked to it in raising questions about how that should be done. And it should be said, too, that very broadly, it, I think, was very, very important in the broader history of just racial representations, since, representations of Haitian insurgents as barbarians, as uncivilized, as violent, and so forth, certainly circulated and were important. At the same time, there were representations, very positive representations. So it was a kind of zone of war over the meaning of race, even after the war had ended.
Well, what side do you take when you hear about arguments like, you know, these people were incredibly violent, they committed atrocities against their against their owners and masters, against the white elites in Saint-Domingue, and therefore that somehow takes the gloss, I'm right. probably not you saying that right, off the Haitian Revolution. How do you respond?
Well, it's easy, I think, from our comfortable position here, or to criticize what people did at that time. It's certainly true that I don't think that the Haitian Revolution was, in fact, it's often, I think, seen as like much more violent than the French Revolution. In a way, Toussaint Louverture actually disputed that himself, and when he was writing, and I think that's kind of disputable. Revolutionary processes are really very brutal often, especially the case in France was the case as well. But even in the United States, we often gloss over the kind of more ugly aspects of the American Revolution and the partisan warfare in the South and other areas. So I think that, you know, I would find it very difficult for us to say now that slaves shouldn't have taken up arms to defend their rights. I think there are context, there are moments where I might say, well, that probably wasn't the best choice and things went too far and so forth, obviously. But overall, I think in the basic sense, the use of violence by slaves against their enslavers, I think was legitimate ultimately. And I think most people probably, and certainly most of my students when we debate this, feel that that's probably true, that the situation of slavery was so deeply violent and that there was really no other option for slaves. You know, they had no place to petition. Any kind of gesture of resistance was met usually with death or torture very quickly. In that sense, you know, there was a situation in which they had really no other option than to have a successful uprising.
Final minute, Laurent. What did Napoleon Bonaparte say in his deathbed about his decisions with regard to Saint-Domingue?
He realized, I think, rather lucidly, that this was a big mistake, you know, that he really should have probably worked with Toussaint Louverture instead of trying to destroy him. I tend to agree with Napoleon on that point, that actually his ambitions for the Americas would probably have been much better served if he had been able to ally himself with this new elite, which, after all, was willing to do a lot, actually, to preserve the plantation economy. And what they really, though, required was to be allowed to be an elite, for the blacks to be admitted into the high ranks of government and politics. And I think Napoleon, looking back, realized that he'd made a big mistake. It was indeed, until his much later big defeats, a very, very early and important defeat of his.
Laurent Dubois, Laurent Dubois, teaches history at Michigan State University. We've been talking about Avengers of the New World, the story of the Haitian Revolution. Links to that book and to other books and to information about Laurent Dubois on againstthegrain.org. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. It was a great pleasure. I appreciate it.